Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Unfiltered Waters. Today, we are so honored to have our first Paralympian on the podcast, and it is such a special Paralympian at that. Not only one of the greatest Paralympians, but one of the greatest athletes this world has ever seen. Jessica Long is joining us today. Jessica is a 29-time Paralympic medalist. 16 of those are gold. She is a four-time ESPY award winner, a James E. Sullivan award winner, and in 2018, she was included on Forbes's 30 Under 30. She also is a children's book author. She released her book, A Mermaid with No Tail, last year, and just has more accomplishments under her swimsuit than many could ever imagine. She is an unbelievable soul. Her story is so powerful and so impactful. She talks about her story with us today, going all the way back to being adopted from a Siberian orphanage when she was 13 months old, to getting her double below the knee amputation at 18 months old because of her fibular hemimelia, and how she found the sport of swimming, and how it's been a part of her life ever since, and the ups and the downs and everything in between. Jess has experienced success at such an early age. She won 3 gold medals at 12 years old in 2004 at Athens, and is now working towards Paris as being her 6th Paralympic Games. This was such an incredible conversation. Jess is so open about her story and her life. Katie and I had the most incredible time talking to her, and we truly cannot wait for you to hear this one. So without further ado, here is Jessica Long.
This podcast is a Cannonball Media production.
Missy and I have entered our strength era in 2024, and this partnership with Create couldn't have come at a better time. We have both been absolutely loving the Create gummies, especially blue raspberry and their amazing new flavor, watermelon. Creatine is an amino acid most commonly found in your muscles and brain, and some of the main benefits are increasing strength, building muscle, and muscle recovery. What we love most about Create is the fact that it's in gummy form, which makes it so easy to stay consistent in taking such an important supplement. We would recommend this to truly anyone who is trying to optimize their healthy lifestyle. We've got a special code for you. It's unfiltered to receive 20% off your first order. Stay strong and enjoy.
Everybody knows that Katie and I are podcast co-hosts, best friends, and former teammates for Team USA. What you may not know is that we are also hydration accountability buddies. Dialing in electrolyte intake can be beneficial for anyone prioritizing and restoring health through hydration. It also makes your water taste so good.
Element is an electrolyte drink mix free of sugar, artificial colors, and other dodgy ingredients. We have always been really picky about what we put into our bodies to fuel it properly, and Element seriously checks all the boxes to keep us healthy and hydrated.
And guess what? We are giving a free gift with purchase to all of our Unfiltered Waters family. You can receive a free Element sample pack with any order when you purchase through our custom URL, which we will link below.
The Element sample pack includes one packet of every flavor, 8 total, perfect for finding your favorite flavor, which mine, by the way, is watermelon. This offer is available for new and returning customers who click our link. You can even get a free sample pack with every Element purchase by purchasing through our link. Drink up.
Oh, we're so happy to have you, Jess. We've both known you for such a long time, and you've been such a dear friend, but inspiration to both of us. So we're so excited. You're also our first Paralympian.
Yes.
Which is so exciting, but something that we are actively going to incorporate into this podcast is providing it for a platform, not just for Olympians, but for their equals in the Paralympics as well. So we're really excited and couldn't imagine anyone better to kickstart off the Paralympic athletes that we'll share on this platform.
Oh my gosh, I love that. Thank you.
Of course, love. Well, we are going to get started We know that you've talked about your background so much, so we don't want to spend too much time on it, but we would like to just have a little snippet of your story because it is so powerful. And for those that haven't heard it, it's so important for them to know what you've been through, how you got to where you are. But so shortly, I know it's a lot to condense, but maybe just give us a little background to your adoption, to your diagnosis, the amputation, the surgeries that you've had, kind of just a generalization of what life has been like for you up to this point.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was born to a 16-year-old girl in Siberia, Russia. And because of my leg deformities, she put me in a Russian orphanage. And right at that time, my now parents in Baltimore had two children, couldn't have any more. They were told they had secondary infertility, adopted me and another little boy in the same orphanage. And it's amazing because they did end up having two more kids. But what they didn't realize when they adopted me is that, you know, I was born with fibular hemimelia. So I had a foot on each side of my legs. I was missing the fibula bone. I had a foot with three toes. What they didn't realize, though, is when I had my very first amputation at 18 months, they didn't realize that I would have to continuously have surgeries. So what ended up happening was the bone continually, it just kept growing. And there were times in my childhood that the bone would actually grow and just come through my skin. I would be playing and it would just pop through. So growing up, I had a lot of surgeries. My first surgery was 18 months and it didn't stop until I was maybe 24. And those were some really tough times, really, really dark times for me, just because I don't think I could fully understand it. But what truly helped me was when I found swimming at the age of 10.
Gosh, that's unbelievable. And that was, for me, reading more about your story too, in my own ignorance, having no idea that with that diagnosis, you need to continually have those surgeries. And for you to have to go through them so young. I mean, I truly can't imagine what that was like. And then you found swimming. And swimming gave you a space, you say, of freedom, where you felt like you didn't need your legs. And I think that is so beautiful. How did you get into the sport? Was it something your parents put you into or something that you were just automatically drawn to?
I mean, yeah, I was always drawn to the water. Every Sunday after church, we would go to my grandparents' house and they had a backyard pool. And that's really where my love for swimming started. So I was 3 years old. I loved swimming, but I joined a swim team when I was 10. And that kind of came about just because I was doing gymnastics. And when I'm not wearing my legs, you know, I walk on my knees. But with all the friction and jumping, you know, the doctors were really afraid that I would damage my knees. And they don't really know if I can even get a knee surgery because I don't have a lot of bone below or a knee replacement. So we found swimming. And I just remember, you know, I loved it, right? I didn't have to wear my legs. And back then, you know, my legs were changing so often because every time I had a surgery, I had to get a new set of legs made. I had to learn how to walk all over again. So for me, swimming was truly freedom, right? I didn't have to wear these legs that were 10 pounds each, right? So I could take them off. I could feel like I was part of the team. And, you know, I always said this, but even though I didn't have legs, I had really strong arms and I learned to navigate the water and I watched other swimmers and I only knew backstroke and freestyle, but I kept going back and I truly was never made fun of. And I always say this, but, you know, if I was ever made fun of for being different on the swim team, you know, I wouldn't be the swimmer I am today.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
I think, yeah. I mean, and I think that's a great transition into something that struck both of us when we asked you what is a word that encapsulates you or something that you want to work on. And you said enough. And that, I mean, I have this bracelet that says I am enough from Little Words Project. And it's something that, I mean, it this past year has been transformative for me in terms of feeling enough for the first time in a really long time. And so I want to hear your story of what that word means to you. And then I want to talk about Beijing because I think the two are pretty interlocked. I know they are for me too, but we'll start with what that word truly means to you.
Oh, yeah. I honestly like really thought about it. And that was the one that kept coming back to me just because, you know, I think for me, my whole life, I've just wanted to be enough.
Yeah.
Right. From the moment that I was put up for adoption, right. You know, it took me a long time to even learn forgiveness with my birth mom, you know, and that came much later on in my life when I met my birth mom. But for a long time, and even to this day, you know, there are still moments and I'm in therapy and I had therapy today, but just moments where I have to remind myself that no matter no matter what, that I am enough. Through, I'm enough through my performances, right? The good and the bad. I'm enough even though I'm missing half my body. I'm enough even though I was put up for adoption. And all of those areas can be really heavy. And I've had to work really, really hard in every single one of those areas, right? From performance to just being, again, being put up for adoption. But I think for a long time, I thought my performance meant that I was loved. And it took me a long time to learn that my performance was just something I do, right? It's something I love to do. I love swimming. And obviously, I love winning. But I realized that I'm so much more than the performance and the medals. And I'm loved for who I am. Mm-hmm.
That's such a good point you bring up. It is so much for someone to work through any three of those things. A diagnosis like fibular hemimelia, getting put up for adoption, and having your sport be such a massive part of your success and your career. You have all three of those things. And it started, again, so early. Like, I found out when we had so much fun doing our research for this. And we were also like, it was one of the hardest interviews to prep for because there was so much to cover.
Where do we start?
You're like, oh my gosh, what do we talk about? Because it's so amazing. And we could keep you here for literally 24 hours talking about it. But your first Olympics, 2004 in Athens, you were 12 and you won 3 gold medals at 12 years old. Like, that is so surreal. And now you're having to work through these emotions that have been a huge part of your life for so, so long. And Katie mentioned Beijing, and you've told some really good stories about that, but especially you had that goal going in of, was it 7 gold medals that you wanted?
I did. Yeah. Yes, I did.
And then you got your first bronze, and walk us through your feelings after that race and your conversation with your parents, because I think that it's an unbelievably powerful story for people to hear.
Thanks. Yeah. Well, I think up until this point for Beijing, right, everything was telling me that my worth was coming from my performance, right? I signed with Nike when I was 14. I won the Sullivan Award. I was breaking world records. I got to go to the ESPYs, right? Like, everything was so incredible. And for me, now I'm older and I realize just keep it to myself and my coach, but I told everyone that I wanted to win 7 gold medals. And, you know, my determination back then had never really failed me, or, you know, so-called failure. And I get to Beijing, I'm 16 years old, you know, I've been swimming for 6 years at that point. And I had done really well, right? I had won a few gold medals. And then it came for my 100 breaststroke. And I just remember breaststroke feeling off, right? That's one of my hardest strokes, with not having the lower part of my legs. It was one of the longest strokes it took me to learn. But I just remember, for whatever reason, it was off. And I was a world record holder, so I was expected to win. I didn't even think I wouldn't lose. You know, I thought I would easily win, right? And I jump in, and I just didn't have the performance that I thought I would have. And my teammate ended up winning the gold medal and breaking the world record. And we were actually in the medal ceremony room, where she was like, "You're in the wrong position, Jess. You should be in second place." And I was like, no, I didn't even get second. I got bronze. And, you know, now as I, you know, 31, you know, we all call it our like rosé medal. I'd be thrilled to get a bronze medal in Paris. But back then it was like, people just looked at it as a failure. Yeah. And I can't even believe that, because when I touched that wall, like, one of the reporters just mentioned that to me, you know, "You didn't do what you said you were going to do. This is, you know, you failed. You didn't get the 7 gold." And I just remember being like, I can't even process what happened. And I finally found the courage, you know, I'm 16, right? I finally found the courage to go up to my parents in the stands. And, you know, I just remember thinking, like, they've seen me win gold up until this point. Why would they ever want to see this medal? And I mean, I was ready to throw that off the balcony and never see it again. But I finally found my parents, or my mom and my parents, they were all there. And I had never really cried. I think that's one thing to know about, like, through my whole life, right? I thought strength was not showing weakness. Right now, I realize that strength is true vulnerability. But at that point, you know, I was getting really emotional. And my parents hadn't seen me cry through all of my surgeries, through all of the ups and downs, right? So my mom pulled me into a stairwell, and I sat down, and I was just starting to tear up. And I was just like, you know, do you guys still love me? Like, do you love me even, like, with this bronze medal? And I think that had really shocked them, because I didn't come from swimming parents. You know, they were just happy if I finish the race. You know, my dad would take me to Dairy Queen if I got disqualified, right? Like, they were just so like, Jess, this is your thing, we support you. But I think that was a huge moment, mm-hmm. right? I think that was a really big moment for us as a family, just to be like, Jess, we love you for you. Like, we don't care about any of this. We're just proud of you. And it's so funny because I actually came back from Beijing and I was like, I'm retiring. I told everyone I was retiring at 16. And I did. I took a good chunk of time off. But it was a really big moment for us as a family, but also for me. And I think also 16 was a really hard age for me just because I knew that was the age that my birth mom had me, right? And at this point, I hadn't met her yet. So there was just so much that was just really hard, especially thinking that I failed. And, you know, I had already felt like I was such a failure coming into this world. So it was a lot of emotions. And I'm so thankful that my parents and my friends just allowed me to take some time. And, you know, it was never pushed on me to go back to swimming, right? It was like, Jess, if you want to quit, we support you. But it was definitely a big moment for us as a family.
How long did it take for you to believe that? And I ask that meaning like, you know, your parents, your coaches, your friends can tell you you're enough. They can tell you you're lovable. But if you don't believe it from the inside out, it's not going to work.
Yeah. You know, I think it was such a process. You know, I think really, truly when I felt enough was when I met my birth mom, and that didn't come till I was 20. You know, I had to really work that, you know, I wanted to turn that so-called failure into fuel. So that's when I moved out to the Olympic Training Center a couple years later. But I think it really came when I met my birth mom, right? And I think for the first time in my life, it was a moment where it wasn't just about me, but her putting me up for adoption, right? And I don't have kids yet. I can't imagine what that's going to be like when Lucas, my husband, and I have our own kids, and just the amount of love that she actually had to put me up for adoption. But I think when I first met her and I just realized how much she loved me, that I was always enough. And just also that power of forgiveness, right? It's so incredibly, you know, I had been holding on to so much anger and frustration and wanting to prove to everyone that I was enough. But, you know, I realized in those moments after Russia, at probably around the age of 24. I mean, it's been a process. It didn't come right away, but just to realize that I was always enough.
And you can totally say if you don't want to share, but what was that moment like the first time you meet your birth mom? Like what are the emotions? I can't even imagine.
It was so, I mean, it's just wild, right? Because there would be so many moments where, you know, I don't really look like my family. I mean, people will tell me that I look like them, and my sister, you know, she has red hair, and, you know, I'm like the only blonde in my family. And there'd be moments in my life where I would just stare at myself in the mirror, right? I would just try to figure out what I looked like. And, you know, I have green eyes and, you know, obviously blonde hair, but, you know, I just wanted to know what she looked like. And so many people would tell me to look in the mirror. And then came the time when I met her and I truly look like her, right? I have the green eyes, I have the blonde hair, but I was just such an emotional trip. I'm trying to think, it was like 10 years ago. I had gone to the orphanage I was adopted from, and they said I was the only orphan to ever go back. So already this trip is like so emotional. Wow. I'm like, oh my gosh, I met the woman who handed me over to my dad. Oh, she remembered me. I was like, hi, like, hello. We had three translators, right? So, but the time came when I met her, and she's in this tiny little purple house, and I'd kind of been communicating with her, through Facebook for about a year. And I knew about a sister, Anastasia. It really shocked me that my birth mom and my birth father got married, just because I never in my wildest dreams expected that. And it could have gone in any other way, right? It could have been that she didn't want anything to do with me. But, you know, you could hear her crying inside the house. Mm-hmm. And I walked around the back and you could just hear her sobbing. And she comes out and hugs me. And again, remember, like, I didn't really like to cry or show emotions, even at 20. And, I just remember hugging her and having this moment where I was like, oh my gosh, like this is my mom, like my birth mom. Like I never thought I would meet her. And my dad, my birth father, dad, I don't even know, was crying. And my sisters, and I have a set of twins as siblings. So it was just this insane moment that sometimes I'm like, did that really happen? Mm-hmm. But she actually wrote me this morning, which is really cool, my birth mom. So we were still in contact. But I think for me, the biggest thing is just, you know, I just realized like just how much I truly forgave her. And that was so much more, just lifted so much more off even my shoulders than I ever realized it could.
That is so powerful, Jess. First off, thank you so much for sharing that with us. That is such a beautiful story. And that notion of forgiveness at the end there, I know that you've talked a lot about one of the things I've loved that you talked about is how you didn't really believe in therapy and now you've gotten into it, but especially how one of the things you've been working through is how your anger has really fueled you and like been a big motivator for you. So I would love if you could touch on that a little bit of, you know, maybe before and after forgiveness, is that anger still something that fuels you or is it something different now?
Yeah. Wow. You guys really did the research. I'm like, oh my gosh, literally, that's like what we talked about in therapy today.
This is actually your second session for the day.
I actually feel like multiple people that we've interviewed, they're like, oh, I had therapy earlier. Yes. So it's like really priming the answers for us.
Oh my gosh. You know, I think for me as a child, right, I was just so angry that I didn't have legs, right? It just seemed like it was so unfair. And you know, we talked even in therapy today just about like, I'm so used to being in a constant state of pain, right? My legs will always hurt me, right? Our bodies aren't made to just have prosthetics. And I think for me, I was just really angry. And that anger really came when my little sister was born, especially when my two little sisters were born, because I'll never forget, you know, I'm 4 years old and Hannah came and I was just so confused. You know, I had a hard time comprehending. And now when I look back, I realize in a way my little body was in a very much, you know, fight or flight mode, right? I was in survival mode just to survive the next surgeries, right? You know, as a three-year-old, you know, I was climbing on the little operating table and holding my mask. But, you know, I think for me, I was just really angry because I couldn't understand why my sisters had legs. I didn't have legs. And, you know, up until the Paralympics, right, I never saw anyone that looked like me. And I told this once to my mom and she was like, what about the prosthetic appointments? And I was like, you know, they were all older people. But I think, you know, for me, I was just so angry. And even swimming was a place to get out the anger, right? It was a way that I could just be in physical pain, almost in my own choice, because every day I didn't choose to be an amputee. Like I still to this day, like, it doesn't go away, right? I'm still an amputee. I'm still walking in pain. But I think as a little kid, I love that idea of swimming because it was my choice to even put myself in that physical pain. But I think for me, truly what a lot of that pain was really gone when I really like accepted Christ as my savior, which was so confusing to me because you talk about not being enough. I never felt like I was good enough to be part of God's family. And I didn't even, you know, I grew up in a Christian household and a lot of what I heard was, you know, it was part of God's plan for you to be part of our family and part of God's plan. And I just was like, I don't want anything to do with God if he made me like this. Like, that doesn't sound like a God that I want to be a part. Like, I didn't want any part of it. But I found an incredible church in Colorado when I was living out there. And I think for me, that was when I realized just all the layers were just, you know, God was like, you know, I know I made you a fighter, but I don't know. It was just a moment where I just gave him my whole heart. And I truly felt like I was enough, you know, to be part of God's family. So after all that, I was like, well, how the heck am I supposed to swim? Right. Because I was like, I don't even know how to swim. Like, it was rough for a little bit. Yeah, it was really rough, but it's been a long process. It's been a really beautiful process. And sometimes even today in therapy, I'm like, I just to remind ourselves, it's important to give ourselves grace, right? Just to see all the process, right? It's not linear. It's one mountain after the other. And it's amazing to look back and see how many mountains you've climbed and you've always made it to the top. So it helps.
You have always made it to the top.
You have. Well, that's actually a great segue into, so we were obviously looking back over your career and you've made it to five Olympics. I mean, not made it to, you've crushed five Olympics. And so this question might throw you off. So prepare yourself. So if your life and the Olympics was a Netflix show and each of your Olympics was a different season, what would there be a word or a sentence to describe each of those Olympics? So episode one is 2004. So on and so forth.
Okay. This is actually
us prepping Netflix for something they should do in the future.
Netflix, this is your idea. I'm trademarking this now.
This is going to be something that I'll like say stuff that comes to mind, but I'm going to be thinking about this all day and I'm going to be like, why didn't I say that? I don't know. I just think the first episode, Athens, right? I was just excited, right? Mm-hmm. Like it was just, I don't think I'm going to do this exercise right, but
whatever you do is perfect. Yeah. Whatever you do is perfect.
Okay. I was just the underdog, right? Nobody expected little 12-year-old for me to win. And then there was just so much pressure, you know, the pressure in Beijing. And then I think I really, there was a lot of light and love in London. I love London. I really learned to control the controllables and just have fun. Mm. Rio was probably truly the most depressing time, right? That's when I had an eating disorder. You know, it was just a hot mess. There was a lot going on there, just out of my control. And I just wanted it to be done. Mm. I was like, this is just, I need a do-over. And then Tokyo truly was like, just that redemption, right? Mm. I was like, I almost quit. I was so proud that I kept holding on, and just to see all the good that still came from just pursuing my dreams again.
You just nailed that. What are you talking about? That was like, there was a, every time you said that, I was like, title. Okay, go scroll down, click, 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 press play. Like, that's what I was envisioning as you were saying that.
Okay, good. I would watch every single one, and it speaks so much to your longevity, Jess, because I think there's almost this misconception that the hardest part is getting to the top, when in reality, the hardest part is staying there. And for you to have done it, oh my gosh, for almost two decades now, it's unbelievable. And I really want our listeners to understand just how incredible it is, the accomplishments that you have had in our sport. Over 29 Olympic medals, over 50 world championship medals. Like, Jess, your stats and your accolades are unbelievable, but that makes it even more powerful when you do admit and are vulnerable and saying, absolutely, there are times that were so hard and I did want to quit and I almost did. So maybe take us back, if you would, to Rio. And how did you get through that? Because we get asked a lot, especially from younger athletes, did you have days that you wanted to quit and how did you get through it? So walk us through that time in your life and how you decided to keep going and how you knew it was what you wanted. Hey everyone, we just wanted to give a super special shout out to our amazing production staff over at Cannonball Media. We have an amazing team behind this podcast and we couldn't do it without them. So thank you so much for all of your help.
If you're looking to start your own podcast, they take care of everything from A to Z. So reach out to cannonballmedia.co.
Sleep is the foundation to performance and longevity. It is either enhancing your performance or holding you back from your highest potential. Dream Recovery is committed to just that, helping people sleep as well as possible so they can conquer the day. Dream Recovery believes in the power of evidence-based solutions to optimize sleep and recovery.
Yes, and everyone deserves to feel their best, and that starts with a great night's sleep. So many of our own Unfiltered Waters guests use Dream Recovery's sleep mask and mouth tape, including Carson Foster and Michael Andrew, and they swear by how much it has helped their sleep and performance in the pool. Visit dreamrecovery.io to have your best sleep ever. Use code UNFILTERED for 30% off your entire order and 50% off your first month of Dream Tape. Sweet dreams.
Yeah, well, I think it's important to go back to like even the training a couple years before Rio, because, you know, I think for so long, you know, people had been so excited to call me an Olympian. And I was like, I am kind of an Olympian, but I'm a Paralympian, right? I'm so proud to be a Paralympian. But a lot of people would just completely look at me differently if I corrected them from Olympian to Paralympian. And I definitely got sick of that. I was like, okay, this might be another challenge, right? I love getting out of my comfort zone. So I decided to move back home to Baltimore and train at NBAC with Bob Bowman and that whole group. And I loved the athletes. But I think for me, it was just really incredibly challenging. I mean, it was challenging in the best way, right? I did all the workouts, short course. Sometimes if we were doing 150s or 200s, I would do 150s because short course is just so challenging for me with the flip turns. But over that course, you know, I just really started to struggle with an eating disorder, right? Just constant weigh-ins, you know, always told I was too big, which is just crazy because I was not. But I think that really took a toll on me. And then on top of all of that, just never feeling like I was skinny enough. And I mean, I can remember being called up into a meeting one day and I had only had coffee and cheese, which I think I did after the Devil Wears Prada. But I was like, I didn't eat for 3 weeks, right? Maybe this is how to do it, right? And we were swimming 10 practices in 6 days, right? I know, like NBAC.
I mean, can I just pause? Like, I know exactly the workouts you did because I did them. And it's yeah, astounding that you were doing that. And you say like, oh, I did 150. No, like that's doing the workouts. Like that's insane.
And starving like, yourself at the same and time.
I mean, yeah, just, sorry. Uh-huh. I just needed to like people to like the yeah, fact that you're doing that and everything on top of that is incredible.
Thanks. Yeah, sometimes I look back. And I was long course, so I was like distance with the girls.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was one time I got called up into the office and I hadn't eaten for like 3 weeks, coffee and cheese, and was just told I needed to lose more weight. And I was just like, I mean, back then, you know, I was 22. Now I would never, ever put up with that. But I think going into Rio, it was just one thing after another, right? I lost 20 pounds. I don't even know how, right? I think because of that, I was just so weak. I had a really bad shoulder injury. On top of all of that, you know, in Paralympics, there is misclassification, and people got really good in 2016, just faking disabilities. And they've really tried to clean it up and made the system a little bit harder. Because in Paralympics, we are in different classifications. But when I got to Rio, you know, I was up against girls with legs. Like, I was looking around, the only amputee making finals. And that's so not the Paralympic movement, right? That's what makes it so sweet and special and amazing, is we're elite athletes with disabilities and we have classifications for fair play. But I think on top of the eating disorder, the shoulder injury that I had, you know, the performance, like, it took me till day 10 to win a gold medal. And like, for so long, you know, I've looked at that as such a failure, right? Like, oh my gosh, it took till day 10. And I've really tried to change my mindset that, wow, Jess, on day 10, the longest day, the longest week of your life or whatever, somehow you were able to do it. And I remember getting out of the pool and just crying. But when I got home, right, that failure piece, you know, I just remember thinking, I wish it was a do-over. Like, a lot of my world records were broken. People didn't want anything to do with me. And I was just like, I'm done, right? Because the sport that I had given so much to, right? As swimmers, we pour our heart and soul into it. Like, you know, for me as an athlete with no legs, right, I can't afford to have off days. Like, I have to give 110%. But for me, I felt like I had done everything right, right? I had showed up to practices with able-bodied swimmers. I had been present. I had worked so hard, right? But I think it's really important for anyone to listen to, right? You know, no matter what, just, you can't be bitter. Right? Don't leave the sport being bitter, right? Because one day that will catch up to you. And it took me a little bit of time, and truly the best thing that ever helped after Rio, I ended up coaching an all-girl swim team. And this was a way that I was just able to take just the sadness and frustration off of myself and just see swimming through the eyes of like these young girls. And I completely, like, slow, it took time, but it slowly just changed my perspective on the sport. And I just realized how much swimming has given to me, right? It's so easy. Anyone can pick out the negatives, but you know, when you can break down the positives and all that swimming has given us, you know, even, you know, the tough days. And I honestly remember the tough days and the bad days more than some of the good days, but it truly just changed my perspective. And I just remember being like, I'm not ready to give this up. To see the joy in their eyes, I was like, you know, I was that little 10-year-old girl once. So tough days come, they're part of the process. It's part of moving forward. Just as long as you don't stay in that bitter phase too long. I think that is true. I don't know. To me, that's like a real true champion. But it took a long time, and I did decide to train for Tokyo. I was like, what's one more?
But, yeah. And now here we are with what's another one.
Here we are. I want to go back for a second. Something you said, and I get this question all the time. I know you do too, of the fact that you won a gold medal on day 10. And I think so many athletes ask, like, what happens if I start the meet badly? What happens if I gain time? Like, how do I stay mentally in it? And I know I struggled with this, where it's like, on my first race, I put so much pressure on because I was like, that means that's how the rest of the meet's going to go, which is not true, right? But it's very difficult to get out of that. How did you do that for 9 days leading up to finally breaking through on day 10?
Yeah, oh my gosh. I mean, in some ways, it's really tough. You just have to like take that day and be frustrated, and then move on and know that you have another race and that it's not over. And that, you know, I mean, I love the side of the mental toughness, just because I feel like that's what really has allowed me to make it through all these Paralympics. And sometimes I'm like, I wonder if the mental toughness came from being an amputee, right? All those years in the operating room, all those years of having to learn how to rewalk, right? To me, quitting was never an option. So I often think in the Paralympics, right, I've done it so many different times, and honestly, I've always said it's the mentally tough who survive, right? Because it's not the most amazing conditions. You know, it's amazing to be with your best friends, but it's sometimes really hard, right? For us, we have to walk far to the international zone. A lot of us don't have limbs, right? Like, it's not exactly the easiest setup either. But I think mentally, celebrate or be upset, whatever you have to do for that first day, but know that you have more days. And if you can find a way to not waste too much energy on that first day and know that you still have races on the last day, I think that's always been really helpful. I don't know if that answered that.
No,
it did. And that's a life lesson too, yeah. right? Like that's a swimming analogy that just carries over into life, yeah. right? Is if you're most in a momentum, right? That you're just, you're in a funk and you can't get out of it. It's just trusting and having that mental strength and fortitude is so important. And having that belief in yourself of, I can do hard things. I've done them before. I'm going to continue doing them. And you found that in sport and you've shown it in sport time and time again, which is so inspiring to all of us. If you don't mind, because I think selfishly, I would love to know a little bit more about it, but I want to be respectful also of the fact that as a Paralympian, it is not your job to educate us on things like this. But if you are okay with it, I would love to learn more about the classification system and how it works, because I'm so confused by it.
Well, and how these girls just cheated their way in.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's, that makes me angry. I don't even know all the details. And like, I'm just already fuming. I'm already fuming.
It's so intricate. So like the classifications, right? You do a bench test and then you do a water test and you can bring in all your medical records and they try to figure out what classification you would be based off of your movements, your amputation, where it stops. And they try to make it as even for all of the swimmers. For me though, you know, it's really hard when you're an amputee because obviously you can see it's like cut and dry. But for someone who has like a neurological disability or say an accident that affected, you know, just the nerves or cerebral palsy, right? Like that can be so much more challenging because what ends up happening sometimes is people will get classified when they find out about the Paralympics. And oftentimes water is used as a form of therapy and what people can be so incredibly strong in the water, right? Like that's why I love swimming, right? I can't run to save my life, but I could swim for hours. So I think that was kind of the part with the like misclassification is sometimes people are in a classification, they get classified. And then they stay in that classification, but the water can allow them to get stronger. And then it's like a whole thing. But I'm an S8, so I compete against other S8s. I'm a bilateral amputee. They measure my bones below the knee to make sure that works. I also race girls with one arm above the elbow. But they have this whole system and percentage, and they figure it all out. And you have to do, water test, bench test, and they'll do review swims and stuff. But I think really a lot of the misclassification just kind of, you know, I think more just Paralympics started growing. And I think sadly, you know, if there's a place to cheat, sometimes people do. It happens with drug testing. It happens, you know, it just happens. So they have really tried to clean up the system just to have more fair play and to make it tougher. But in 2016, it was a little rough.
How often do you have to redo the testing?
So because I haven't had any changes with myself, right? Like my legs aren't growing back. I am like a confirmed S8. So nothing's changing for me. But for someone who say they have like a TBI or like if something else happens, they might have to get tested once a year to confirm their classification. But I think the hardest thing is people know when they're being watched, right, for review swims. Mm-hmm. And I think we're so good at navigating water. And that's something that sometimes you see. But I do believe that they're trying to make it a better system and more articles have come out, but it was really tough in 2016. And kind of what had happened was I had three girls that dropped down from an S9 to an S8. Break my records. And then within 3 months, they all went back up to an S9. So it was just a really challenging, especially even then, right? I was like, my worth doesn't come from this, but then all of a sudden I wasn't getting the results I got. And I had to really like work on that even all over again. So it's always a process to be enough, but
always a process. So thank you so much for explaining all of that. Cause I think that too is like something that, you know, just watching it, you don't always see or understand. So for encouraging everyone to be as involved as the Paralympics as they are in the Olympics, it's so awesome for them to know that and understand and have that little bit of background knowledge. I want to go back a little bit to NVAC and we talk about, you've trained with both groups. You've trained with just Paralympians and you've trained with fully able-bodied. So what are those two experiences like? If you could kind of compare the differences in what you prefer, what was difficult, and where you felt like you found your best motivation and what was the best place for you?
Yeah, I love training able-bodied. Up until I was 18, I actually trained able-bodied swimmers. And then from 18 to 22, I lived at the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs. And that's when I trained with para. And then I trained with Bob and that whole group for a couple years. And honestly, I just think I'm pushed more when it's able-bodied. And I never want to use my legs as an excuse. And now that I'm, you know, 31, I definitely have to be like, look, I can't do 10 doubles a week. But back then, like, I just, you know, there's such a drive, right? When you're born, being born without legs, like, I just want to keep up. And I really found ways when I looked at other swimmers, right? Lotta Freese, I would look at how she pulled water underneath. Like Schmitty, I would see her hand placement. I took different pieces from all the swimmers and I would just watch them, how they swim, right? I didn't have my legs, but I would notice their body position or the way that they rotated or how were they breathing. And I just tried to pick all these little pieces and make it my own. And honestly, like when I think back some of the sets that like Schmitty and I were doing, like I'm like, I can't even believe that I was able to do it. Like we would do 50s butterfly on 45 long course. Like I have no kick, right? I'm like, how the heck was, or 31s. I would be like, oh my gosh, like some of these sets, I can't even believe. And I did pull a lot of it too. Like some of the sets, like I could pull all day long. So I would put on paddles if needed. But honestly, I was always way more challenged when I was training with able-bodied. And I love that. And I've never really had coaches who allowed me to use my legs as an excuse, but that was truly some of the hardest practices I've ever done. But I also realized in that moment that it was so much bigger than myself, right? I think the most important thing was I needed to get into the Olympic world. And I'm so thankful for Tom Luxinger, right? Because he was my butterfly, but like everyone was just so incredible. And I'm almost, sometimes I wondered if Bob let me come out there for thinking in 6 weeks, he was going to be like, look, this isn't good. This is not going to work. But I think I surprised him. And I, you know, Michael, we've always known each other since, you know, being from Baltimore, but I think he had a big say too, in just being like keeping people out there. But, no, it's truly the hardest thing I've ever done. But training with Paralympic athletes is also great, right? I tend to like to train with the boys in Paralympics. I feel like that's who I can keep up with better. But yeah, I would definitely train able-bodied over Paralympics.
And what's your training look like now?
Oh my goodness. Okay, here we go. I have been completely and totally training by myself. Oh, and geez. I am like not making, like it has been so incredibly challenging. So I am actually hopefully moving back out to the Olympic Training Center. Okay. But it's been probably the like hardest 2 years, right? Just no support, haven't had a team, have tried to go to a few places, and it's been really tough with NCAA rules just because I'm a pro, like all this stuff. But like today I didn't go to swimming, right? Like I was like, I'm not swimming.
How are you mentally with that? The fact that you didn't go?
Well, obviously there's athlete guilt, but I think more than anything, like I am at a point where I need people and I need community. And I have trained before by myself, but right now I don't even, it's been really tough. And I have tried a lot of things, but I'm very hopeful. And if everything works out with the training center, I would be moving out Monday.
Oh, wow. So
but I'm just trying to go off of, you know, Jess, you've got the data, you've got the muscle memory, you've got the fight in you, you've got 9 months. It's been really tough, right? We had an extra year with COVID. Everything's been tough for everyone. You know, that was obviously tough for everyone, but all of a sudden we have 3 years instead of two, you know, four. But yeah, it's been really tough, right? I'm at a point, you know, I've been swimming for 20 some years, 21 years, and just not having a coach or swimming by myself, I'm like, I'm just not, I just want to talk to people. But it's all going to be okay. It's going to be okay. I've been having meltdowns, but it's going to be okay.
It will be. And that's such a good insight into the kind of decisions that Olympians and Paralympians have to make. Like you are literally in between a rock and a hard place of I either keep training by myself and it's detrimental to my mental health and my motivation, or I go to the Olympic Training Center, but then you're leaving Lucas and you're leaving home. And that's a really hard decision too. But just so inspired by your notion of, okay, I'm trying something and it's not working, so I'm going to do something about it. And I think just that thought process and having to make those hard decisions has been such a massive factor in what's kept you where you are for so long and in the sport and a legend of not just Paralympics, not just swimming, but as an athlete, the legend that you are. And looking at Tokyo and coming off of that, obviously, we've only had 3 years, which is so different. You've already accomplished so much. So in these 3 years, off of Tokyo into Paris, what are you still looking to accomplish in this sport?
This truly is therapy. you know, I've been trying to really figure that out. Yeah. I think, you know, I love the sport. I'm not ready to give it up. I've always seen myself retiring in LA, right? And I believe that my race, this big race, this whole race that I've been in, right, is not done. I'm not done yet. And for me, swimming is always going to be the best form of exercise, but I do want to be a legend, right? I don't want to just be good. I don't want to be great. I want to be the best.
Iconic.
And yes. Oh my gosh. I love that. But it was so hard. Like after the Super Bowl commercial, right, where millions of people saw my story. You know, I just remember thinking, oh my gosh, like I have to do well in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. And there was just so much relief. And for me, you know, I grew up with my hero, Erin Popovich, who's another Paralympic swimmer, yes. And she had 14 Paralympic gold. And she set the bar so high. And there was this really sweet moment when I surpassed her gold medal count in Tokyo, where I got to hug her and was just like, thank you so much for all that you've done for Paralympics. Because, right, like Paralympics wouldn't be what it is today without her, right? It's that ripple effect. But I think for me, that was truly like, thank you for setting the bar so high. And to have the 16 gold medals, like, is so exciting. But I also know that, like, I'm so much more than those. But I don't know. Sometimes it's more like, can I just prove to myself that I can do it again, right? Mm. Just to be there, right? Like, I can't end on Tokyo because my family, Lucas, you know, my siblings, they weren't there. So I think for me, true success means getting to Paris, because it has been so hard the last 2 years. And there's been not a lot of support. But I'm so proud of the people who have supported me and who believe in me. And I just can't regret. I can't have any regrets, right? And I think that's one thing. The time is going to go. And I want to get to Paris and know that, okay, you sacrificed some time and it was hard, but it was worth it. And Lucas isn't going to leave my side, right? My family's always going to love me. So even though living out at the training center is going to come with its own challenges, I think there's a peace knowing that, you know, I made the sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that.
It's been tough.
So powerful.
If it's too much therapy, tell us. But you've talked about, I think it's really important for people to hear, like, you know, I do this too. Like, I casually, I'm like, oh, I had a meltdown. Oh, like, you know, like, what happens when you have a meltdown, and how do you then kind of reset, pick yourself back up? Like, what are things or words or mantras that you say to yourself to keep going?
Yeah, no, I really love that. Yeah, it's funny. Actually, yesterday I kind of had a meltdown with Lucas, because I was like, I just could not feel more unprepared, right? I hurt my shoulder like a month ago at Nationals, which is part of the reason I'm not swimming as much too, but also like being alone, I'm like, oh my goodness. You know, just yesterday I was talking to him and I was like, I could not feel more unprepared, right? I haven't really swam in the last couple of weeks, the holidays, coaching. Like, it was just a moment where it felt good to just, obviously with my husband, it's a safe place, but like, just to be like, all these things feel like it's so heavy, right? And it's not just one obstacle. It feels like there's so many different obstacles. And he was just like, Jess, you know, you've gotten through every tough moment. You're going to get it done. You always do. You're that mentally tough person. And just like all the encouraging words. But I think for me, something that's really helping me, you know, just getting me to move forward, is I've always loved the quote, you know, fall down 7 times, stand up 8. You know, I have fallen down so many times. I've had so many different failures, you know, but I've always found a way to pick myself back up. And on Team USA, we actually have this really fun, like, 5-minute rule. So if anyone, and we've done this for years, that if anyone has a bad race or a bad moment or just something happens, you have 5 minutes to be upset. And then you have to come back and like cheer for your teammates and you cheer for the rest of the session. And honestly, I've taken that in so many different areas of my life, that if, you know, I have a bad moment, like talking to Lucas, like I went off for a few minutes and then I was like, I have to go. And then I called him right back and I was like, sorry, that was dramatic. I'm okay. But sometimes it's good to just get it out and then find a way to just be like, no, you can do it. Like, yes, you've got some obstacles, but honestly, would you not want to, like, obstacles make it somewhat fun. Like, you can do it. Like, and I just talk to myself in the mirror and I honestly, I'm just like, don't you dare give up. Like, this, you've never given up. And there's honestly, there is a quote that I really like and I just can't think of it. But just telling myself that, like, you've never given up and you're not going to start now.
I mean, 5-minute rule is about to be applied to every aspect of my life.
I love that, because I think so many times, like, kids or adults, like, it's like, oh, you have to keep it together. You have to be tough. You know, shove it down. It's fine. Yes,
but
keep moving.
This validates what you're feeling.
This validates, like, I want to punch things and I want to scream. And like, it's natural. It feels so good. Yeah. Like, I think that's great kids do it. Why don't we keep that up?
Yeah. And allowing yourself to feel like that, but then being like, okay, I got it out. I talked about it. I had that space. And now, moving forward, like, what are we going to do? I think that's amazing.
Let's implement that pre-podcast.
Done.
Tech issues. Okay, good.
done.
Yeah, my 5-minute rule this today was more like 20 when I was trying to log in. I was like, are you freaking kidding me? But yeah, no, it's been really helpful. But that's what it was. I remembered it. It's, you've always had the power, my dear. You just had to find it for yourself, or whatever that quote is. But I literally, when I'm swimming, sometimes I'll just be like, you've always had the power. You just had to find it for yourself, or figure it out for yourself. So that's my other favorite quote.
That's beautiful, Jess. I love it. Well, we'll end on a little bit of a lighter note. We're almost done. Before we get to our final questions, I do want to talk about the Super Bowl commercial just for a second, because it was so beautiful. It was so well done. So
iconic. Iconic.
Literally iconic. I believe you filmed it in South Africa, and you and Lucas even stayed after to do a little honeymoon for yourself. So tell us a little bit about the process of filming a Super Bowl commercial, maybe any funny behind the scenes that people wouldn't expect, and then about you and Lucas after, just taking some time for yourself.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So I couldn't even believe that I was like chosen to be part of it was supposed to be like a Start Your Campaign or Start Your Impossible campaign with Toyota. And I became a Toyota athlete in 2019, and we filmed that maybe the end of 2019. So this was just a point in my life where, you know, I was rebuilding, I'm coaching with the girls, I decided to train for Tokyo, but I still think the confidence was just not there yet. So when they pulled me aside and was like, they were like, Jess, like, we've chosen you to do our Start Air Impossible campaign, and we're filming in South Africa. I just could not even believe it.
Did you scream? Like, what was your reaction when, like, the moment they were like, you're going to be in a Super Bowl commercial?
I think I was just like, are you sure? Well, at first it wasn't going to be a Super Bowl commercial.
Oh,
so like it was a story. So like we get to South Africa. Honestly, it was amazing. We stayed for 2 weeks. We filmed for a few days. Something that was super cute for me. Like there were so many, this like truly was like such an like emotional commercial for me. And every time I see it, I like it really, like it hits so hard. But the little girl that jumped over me and the locker room girl, they were sisters, which is really cool.
Oh.
And the little baby in the orphanage was actually half Russian, and I got to hold her in fittings, and I was like, because I was like, of course, like leave it to Toyota to find like a Russian baby to play me. I believe they borrowed the cribs from an orphanage somewhere around there, which I thought was insane.
Wow.
But there was so many details to it, and I think what people would be surprised to know is, you know, at this point, you know, I mean, adoption, I met my birth mom, I love my parents, like all these things. And even the actors look like my parents, right? Like they had so many amazing little details. But when I swam up at the end and I like take off my goggles and I'm breathing and I like look at them getting the phone call, like that was all like that taken in one take. We only had to do it like twice. And they were like, we saw the emotion and like the power. And I just try to think of my parents getting that phone call. And they even got that right. Cause at first I was like, I don't got the phone call, like I don't even know how this worked, but I guess there was some behind the scenes conversations I didn't know about. But my parents did get a phone call. Like it was like everything about it was so beautiful. And like the one day I swam for like hours in a pitch dark pool, they put like tarp all over, like I really swam through every, like it was, there was so much swimming, and it was so exciting. I had my own trailer, but honestly the best part was spending time with Lucas after. And we went to Cape Town and went to a cute little beach town and vineyards and safaris, and we did the whole thing. But it was crazy. So like, okay, so 2019 pandemic hit. So 2020, they told me at Team Toyota Day, they were like, we were just a few days short of submitting your commercial to the Super Bowl for 2020. And I was like, I don't know if you should tell me that, because that like, I can't even believe that was even being considered. And then in August, the end of that year, they called me up and they were like, we actually have chosen it for this upcoming Super Bowl. So 2021. So I knew from August to like February. But there was a lot of prep. There's so much that goes into it. And I honestly was just so nervous for people to actually like to know my story and to see my story. And, you know, I got recognized after that, and I still do, but it was just like, I mean, that was my life story, right? For everyone to see. And it was very emotional. And I was like, there was part of me, I was like, am I ready for this? I just think it's really amazing, because that took 19 years. That was 19 years in the making, right? And I think it's really important for anyone who's hearing this, right, to know that it can take time, right? There were years that I was swimming where people didn't know who I was, that people didn't even know what the Paralympics were. And I just kept trying and trying and trying. And I didn't give up. And even when no one knew my name. And I think it's so important to know that that was 19 years in the making. And there were a lot of days that, you know, I remember thinking, is this worth it? But it's amazing to see how far the Paralympic movement has come, but also to know that that commercial was so much, again, so much bigger than myself, right? It highlighted women in sports, disability, you know, Paralympics. Like, it was just, it was truly amazing. And, you know, I got so many messages from women who were like, I just found out that my baby was diagnosed with fibular hemimelia. And after seeing that, you know, I'm no longer scared. Oh, and it was just like, the messages, I was like, it was so emotional, but it was amazing.
Oh, well, that is so beautiful, Jess. Thank you so much for sharing that experience with us. And before we again get into our last three questions, I just want to thank you for what you do for not only the Paralympic movement, but also for women in sports. Like, you are such an unbelievable advocate, and you already are, in our minds and in so many others, a legend. And we know there's still so much more that you want to accomplish, and we can't wait to watch and cheer you on with all of that. But not just a legend for what you've done in the sport, but also for what you've done outside of it. So thank you so much for all that you've done and are going to continue to do. And with that, we ask all of our guests the same three questions at the end of every episode. So the first one is, what is a single moment in the sport of swimming that has brought you the most amount of joy?
Oh, I love that. Honestly, just being on the pool deck with some of my best swim friends about to jump in. And we're kind of stalling, but then we jump in and then like we're warming up together and we're just laughing and we're getting ready for individual races. But honestly, those moments just have always brought me the most joy to be with my best friends.
I love it. The pre-warm-up stall.
Yeah.
Very well known.
Yeah. You're like, if I push another 5 minutes, I could definitely still have enough time to put my suit on.
Yeah, I can get my suit on a little bit faster.
Yeah, like I'm fast. I'm faster today. I'm feeling quick. awesome. Same question, but outside the sport of swimming.
I mean, I love spending time with my family and my husband, right? You know, those relationships and the people that love me the most and I love them. Like, you know, my family has always done family dinners once a week and I'm so grateful for that. But I would say that's always brought me the most joy, is spending time with my family and Lucas.
He is your family.
Yeah, he is your family.
Yeah. All right. Last question. We touched on this earlier, of course, but if you could pick one word that encompasses your journey, what you've learned, or something that you're working on moving forward, what would that word be and why?
Is this like the same word as before?
Yeah. Well, you can change it
if you want.
If you're feeling different.
No, I mean, two are coming to mind for my words. You know, the first one is enough. And, you know, my whole life I've wanted to be enough. And I think there's going to be moments moving forward that I don't feel enough and moments that I do. And I think it's truly a journey, right? It's ups and downs. And I'm so grateful for all that I've worked through. But I know that there's still going to be tough days, right? I think I'm living proof that anything is possible if you just believe and try your hardest. But I also want to feel enough for myself, not just for others with my story at times. But I would say just feeling enough through my adoption, through my success, through, you know, just being just proud of myself for sure. And then I also just love the word resilience. Mm. You know, I think that's something I'm taking with me as I train for Paris, because, you know, I am older and my body hurts. And more often than not, my mind goes to, you've done enough. You don't need to do anymore. But I know my race isn't done yet. And you know, I can't wait to have my family cheer for me. And even if I win no medals at all, to me, it truly is a success to just get to Paris.
Well, beautiful. Well, Jess, thank you so much for hopping on and being resilient through the tech issues and sharing so candidly. We have had the best time. So we just thank you so much.
Awesome.
Thanks, Jess.
Thank you.
Perfect. Will you tell Lucas we say hi, please?
I will. Yeah, he's somewhere. I think he's coaching, actually.
So but much. Oh, we forgot to talk about the book. Literally have it in.
Can we do like a little like cutaway?
Yes,
like,
you know, a little burp. I mean? Just a quick, can we talk about the book for a second? I want to make sure we get that out there for you. Yeah. Okay, so also one thing we are so excited to talk about, we have a beautiful copy with us in studio. You wrote a children's book, The Mermaid with No Tail. You are so kind. I was so excited because she sent two copies to us. I thought Kate was only going to get a copy, but she sent one for me too. It is so beautiful. Jess, tell us a little bit about the process of writing a children's book. And it is so beautiful and well thought out, really what you wanted to accomplish with writing such a beautiful story.
Thanks. Well, actually, it was my dad was helping me one day, probably like 5 years ago. And he just said, Jess, I have this idea for a children's book. And we were talking through it and it was this mermaid with no tail. And I was like, Dad, I love this idea. So we kind of wrote the whole book together. But it was really his idea and his vision. And I love that. But you know, what made me so excited for this book, you know, growing up, I didn't see books where people look like me, Barbies, I would cut their legs off, dolls, right? And I think it's really important to see just something that looks like you, that representation. And that's why I love the Paralympics so much, to see others like me. But, you know, this book really was just to teach kids that the thing that makes them different is their greatest gift. And, you know, I know firsthand what it's like to always look different and to have my biggest insecurity to be on display for the world to see, right? You know, there were days I hid my legs in the summer, I wouldn't wear shorts. And it wasn't until the Paralympics that I started wearing shorts and showing my legs. And I still get people who look at my legs. Now I'm like, oh, I'm giving you something to look at, like go ahead and look. But I think it's really important. And I told the story really, I think, to a few people, but I was swimming the summer before it was coming out and I was about to take off my legs and there was a summer swim team. And they were little. And I was like, here we go. Kids are curious. They're going to talk.
And they had no filter.
Oh, no filter. And they're just like, what happened to your legs? And I was like, oh my gosh. So, you know, I was born without my legs, right? We're all different. Look at you. But they were just like, that is so weird. And I was like, it's not weird, right? And they were like, how are you going to swim? I'm like, with my arms. But there was one little boy who, out of all the ones who thought it was so weird, you know, was just like, I think it's awesome. And I was like, thank you, Lord. Like, thank you. But see, I think that's the most important thing, is that kids still need to see differences. And I hope this book brought that message to libraries. I think it's in aquariums. Like, it was just such an exciting process. And I never dreamed that it would look so beautiful on the cover. And to have Michael do the foreword was so special. So I was just really proud of it. And I got to see it in Target the other day. So it's been such a fun process. And I'm so glad you loved it.
Of course we did. No.
No, that was perfect. Great.
That was okay, so sorry. Fun. Thank you so much for everything.
Your story talk so much. Sometimes I'm like, oh my God, again. Okay. But yeah.
Unbelievable. We're so proud of you. And I'm sorry to hear that training alone has been super tough. But hopefully everything works out at the training center. And if you need any care packages, we'll put some together and send them your way.
Thank you so much for listening and watching Unfiltered Waters. We are so grateful for your support. If you could please hit that subscribe button on any of the channels that you're watching and maybe even give us a rating or review, we would appreciate it so much. Thank you again, and we'll talk to you soon.